Ready to proceed? I think you're both probably familiar with this, but we've extended time to 17 minutes with the first two uninterrupted by questions from us. And then after that, it's fair game. So how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
I'd ask for 3 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay, very well. You may go.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Amy Yonezawa. With me is trial counsel Quentin Dolente, and we represent appellant Ruben Montadamas Serrano. The issue of guilt in this case was close, and this case turned on whether the jury believed Ruben had specific intent. While all of the issues raised in the brief warrant reversal, I plan to focus on three issues today. First, the district court erred by denying Ruben's Batson challenge, both procedurally and substantively. Procedurally, despite this court repeatedly holding that the district court must apply Batson's three-step process and clearly state its reasoning, the district court here failed to do so. This was structural error. The district court substantively erred by ultimately concluding that the defense did not make a prima facie showing because minorities remained on the jury. That alone is not enough to deny a Batson challenge. This was structural error. The district court violated the Confrontation Clause by allowing testimonial hearsay to come in through a substitute coroner, contrary to Smith v. Arizona. The Supreme Court in Smith specifically rejected the same reasoning the district court relied on here, that the testifying expert was offering an independent conclusion. Additionally, the underlying statements were testimonial because the coroner knew this death involved a criminal act, and it is objectively reasonable to believe that the coroner's statements would be available for use at a trial. Importantly, the coroner's testimony did not just go to cause and manner of death. It went to specific intent. Finally, the district court erred when it precluded the defense expert from testifying that Ruben could not form specific intent. Pundick states that an expert can testify to a defendant's ability to form the requisite intent at the time of the offense. Whether Ruben can form specific intent went to the heart of his defense theory, and it meant the difference between a first-degree murder conviction or not. Turning to the Batson error, the district court here initially made a prima facie finding based on the defense's argument that there was a pattern of strikes and that this case was sensitive to bias. It then allowed the state to make argument regarding that finding and ultimately skipped over step two and went straight to step three and asked the defense to prove purposeful discrimination.
Well, Ms. Yonezawa, you don't dispute, sorry, we're after 2 minutes.
Yes.
You don't dispute that if the court determines a prima facie showing hasn't been made, they're not required to go to the other steps, are they?
That's correct, Your Honor. They would not be required to, but okay. The district court here did say that she specifically found a prima facie case was made. And before she could move on to asking the state to provide a race-neutral reason, the state interjected to make a record about that prima facie finding.
Right. And then after further discussion, the court found there was not a prima facie showing and thus didn't go to steps two and three.
That's correct, Your Honor. But the correct application of the three-step process would have been to move to step two and ask the state for their race-neutral reason. At that step under Williams is when the state can try to rebut the prima facie showing.
Right. Assuming a prima facie showing was made, that would be the appropriate next step.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
So I guess with the fact that 5 of 8 challenges were used on minority jurors alone isn't enough for a prima facie showing. Do we agree on that?
I would disagree with that, Your Honor.
Okay. I think there's case law, but okay.
Well, the cases say that striking a member of a cognizable group alone is not enough. I will note that this court in Barlow did summarily change that standard to say that striking minority veneer members, plural, but does cite to Cooper, which also says a member. Cooper cites to Watson, which also says a member. I think historically the meaning there is that striking one member would not be a pattern. But more than one member, I don't know if that number is 2, 3, but certainly 5 out of 8, more than half, would show a pattern. Additionally to that, the defense also argued that this case was sensitive to bias, which the district court apparently did not consider and certainly did not make any findings regarding. Objectively looking
at... Did that immigration issue end up coming out during the trial at all?
Facts about that immigration issue did come out during the trial, Your Honor.
Right.
Excuse me. I would also note that objectively looking at the data, there was a disproportionate effect of those strikes on the panel as well. The state struck 5 out of 8 minority, or excuse me, used 5 out of 8 of its strikes on minorities. That ended up taking 5 out of 12 minorities off the jury panel. It also resulted in taking 1 out of only 2 African-American jurors off the panel and 2 out of only 3 Asian-Americans off the panel.
So how, if at all, should we consider the fact that when we, the case ended up with 14 jurors, 12 jurors, 2 alternates, I presume, which ended up, I believe, 7 minority, 7 non-minority is my understanding. What, if at all, should we do with that? Does it play a part in our analysis?
It does, but the case law supports that what the number of minorities remaining on the jury should be considered as part of step 3 when determining whether or not there's purposeful discrimination.
Thank you.
And again, even if this court were to consider that the state's arguments truly went to step 2 in some way in attempting to rebut the prima facie case, the district court still erred by failing to go to step 3 and engage in the sensitive analysis and make a finding of purposeful discrimination.
To what extent is it appropriate to, I mean, the record is less than clear as to what happened in the Batson challenge, because you have the court finding you've made a prima facie showing, says step 1, and then there's an interruption, and then there's a dialogue, and then there's more of a ruling from the court. From an appellate review perspective, what should we do with that muddled record?
I think the appropriate thing to do would be to reverse and remand and ask the district court, or remind the district court again, pursuant to your previous holdings, that you have to follow the steps in order. It seems to me, based on the record, that the district court muddled up the steps and was mixing the different standards from the different steps together, and then ultimately just went back to step 1 and said, well, this all falls under the prima facie standard and I'm not going to move on to step 2.
Wouldn't it be appropriate in examining whether the prima facie showing has been made, though, to have the discussion that happened about how many of the then 32 potential jurors were minorities or weren't minorities?
I think that is an appropriate consideration under step 1. Watson certainly suggests that in regard to gender discrimination cases, but under Williams, I think the appropriate way to have that discussion is to, after a court makes the prima facie finding under step 1, you move to step 2, and at that point, that is where the state can try to rebut the prima facie showing.
Right. Sorry, so now I'm not clear about the answer then. Are you saying it is appropriate to look at that at step 1 as to whether a prima facie showing is made, or you don't think it's appropriate at step 1, not until later?
I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question. I think it is appropriate at step 2.
Okay.
But apart from the labeling of the steps, it seems to me there was a fairly extended discussion that could be taken as a discussion altogether on step 1. So setting aside 2 and 3, can you address why the step 1 showing wasn't made if we include the entire discussion as part of step 1?
Thank
Follow
you.
What I'm saying.
Yeah, I do. Thank you for raising that. I did mean to address that. The state's argument, if it's construed as being part of step 1, was that it could not have been racial discrimination because the jury made up more than 50% of the panel and they only used 50% of their strikes on minority jurors. But that's factually inaccurate. There was only 40% minorities, and the state used over 62% of their strikes on minority jurors. So if we're looking at the statistics the way that Watson describes, they did use a majority of their strikes on minority members, and the minority groups on the jury panel did make up, for lack of a better word, a minority number.
And if the court found that that was a prima facie showing, it wouldn't be the end of the determination about whether, in fact, constitutional rights had been violated.
That's correct. I was just going to say that, actually, that so even if a prima facie showing is made, it's a very low standard, and the discussion does continue. And it is not until step three that really the true argument should be had and the district court can make an ultimate determination. So we could always reconsider its decision at step three and decide, I thought maybe there was something here, but now that I've heard all the argument and I know all the numbers, I either do or do not believe that purposeful discrimination is shown.
And because the judge found that there wasn't a prima facie showing, we don't have in the record what the state presents as its reasons for actually striking those jurors.
That's correct, Your Honor. If I could just touch on Smith v. Arizona next. Mm-hmm. The U.S. Supreme Court in Smith specifically held that when a testifying expert is relying on a non-testifying expert's report and analysis in forming its opinion, that testimony, the underlying statements, are hearsay. They are being offered for the truth of the matter asserted, because the testifying expert's opinion is only reliable if the non-testifying expert's opinion is also reliable. And there's no opportunity for the defense to cross-examine the non-testifying expert.
But didn't the testifying expert draw her conclusions, her own conclusions? She wasn't relying on the conclusions of the you're talking about the coroner now, right? So the prior coroner, I guess, made some conclusions, but the one that actually testified at trial came to her own conclusions after reviewing the evidence. Why is that not okay?
Just like in Smith, the testifying coroner did say she had drawn her own independent conclusions, but those conclusions were only accurate if the underlying coroner's report was also accurate.
How is that true? She was looking at the pictures and she's pointing to injuries to this part of the torso and this part of the torso. In pictures that came into evidence.
Right. So there were six pictures that came into evidence that the coroner testified to during trial. All of those photos are external photos of the body. I'll admit I did not provide those photos because I thought they were unnecessarily gratuitous. But, and I think the description in the testimony makes it clear that those are external photos of the body.
Right.
A stab wound is defined, and the coroner testifies to this, that it must be deeper than it is wide. She also testified as to the nature of those injuries, that they penetrated the liver, that one penetrated the tongue. From the external photos, there's no way she could have known that, absent the coroner's report that actually did presumably measure the depth of those injuries and looked internally at the body to determine how far those injuries went.
Was she cross-examined on that?
I don't believe she was, Your Honor.
Well, the defense had the opportunity to ask those questions at trial, right? Like, how can you tell if these photos don't depict that?
Yes, the defense could have asked her that. The only answer she could have provided would be, well, I read it in the coroner's report. And at one point, she does mention that the coroner measured the length of a scar, but never that she did herself.
Were there the pictures, do any of the pictures, because I guess we don't have them, include like a ruler next, you know, sometimes in pictures you see that so you can tell how big it
is? Yes, they do. And again, that would only tell you the measurement of the external injury where the scarring took place on the outside of the body. There was no measurement or indication of how deep those wounds went into the body.
There were also medical records of the victim's treatment in the hospital prior to her death. The original coroner would have relied on those, and so did Dr. Simons, who testified at the time of trial. Do you agree it's appropriate to look at those and rely on those?
Yeah, I think the underlying medical records from her time in hospice care likely would be acceptable to rely on, because those medical records are not prepared with anticipation of litigation in the same way that a coroner's report would be.
But so you think that measuring the depth of a wound in the course of an autopsy and recording that is testimonial that requires confrontation, so that only the technician who did that measurement can testify to that?
I do think that, but the Confrontation Clause isn't only important for that one aspect. The Confrontation Clause allows the defense to challenge that expert who made those measurements, not just on the actual measurement itself, but on their qualifications, on their experience, on why maybe she left the coroner's office. The point of the Confrontation Clause is that we get to confront and challenge that expert, not someone else who's just testifying as to what that expert did. I also think it's important to note in that regard that this wasn't just about the measurement. The state used this testimony specifically to show that Ruben had specific intent to kill.
An argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, you're into your rebuttal.
Yes, I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal if there are no other questions.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Rachel Crum, and I represent Respondent, the State of Nevada, in this matter. The State respectfully requests that this Court affirm the judgment of conviction for first-degree murder with use of a deadly weapon and burglary while in possession of a deadly weapon. Your Honors, this Court should affirm that judgment of conviction for five reasons that rebut appellant's alleged grounds for reversal. First, the district court properly found that appellant ultimately was unable to demonstrate a prima facie case of discrimination. Appellant merely pointed to the number of strikes used for minority jurors as support for their Batson claim and were unable to provide even a theory of a discriminatory purpose. Because there was no clear error in the district court's ultimate decision denying step one, the Batson issue on appeal should be denied. Second, appellant's rights under the Confrontation Clause were not violated when the coroner who testified at trial spoke to her own independent findings and conclusions as to the cause and manner of death, rather than acting as a mouthpiece for the reporting coroner. Additionally, appellant's rights were not violated when the court redacted the preliminary hearing transcript because the objections made by the state were timely upon admission at trial. Third, the district court did not abuse its discretion by limiting the defense expert testimony because he was not qualified to make a legal conclusion, nor was it permitted by case law or statute. Fourth, the district court did not abuse its discretion by allowing the jury to utilize a transcript of the 911 call because it found it to be extremely accurate. Fifth, as just stated, the prior four arguments demonstrate a lack of any error in this case, disproving any theory of cumulative error. I will move first to the arguments made by appellant to Your Honor's discretion. First, concerning Batson, the issue here is appellant was only able to point to the fact that the state struck five minority jurors. They were not able to provide the district court with even a theory of a racial discriminatory purpose. And the district court asked them numerous times if they would be able to provide that. Contrary to appellant's argument, the state's position is that that discussion is appropriate for step one. I understand appellant believes that that is a step three analysis, but this is a totality of circumstance analysis. Specifically in Diamapo, they state that under step one, the defendant must make a prima facie showing based on the totality of circumstances that race-based discrimination occurred. Totality of circumstances would incorporate the discussion that was held after appellant's initial argument when the state was able to make a record. That record was extremely crucial because it was at that time that the district court was provided with the numbers, that the district court asked for a discriminatory purpose. And at that time, of course, is when it failed because appellant was unable to provide even a theory of it.
But isn't the point of the three-step analysis that you're not able to completely prove what the state was thinking at the time? You just present enough to, it's supposed to be a low standard enough to draw an inference just to require the state to respond. Isn't that the way it's supposed to work?
Yes, Your Honor, it is a light standard, and the district court stated that when they denied step one. They said they understand that it is a light burden. However, they hadn't met that because all appellant did in that situation is state that the state struck five minority jurors.
So if minority jurors made up 40% of the potential strike, the jurors that had passed for cause, and 62.5% of the strikes were used on them, isn't that enough for a prima facie showing? Isn't that a statistically significant difference?
No, Your Honor, especially because the operative word in the prima facie analysis is prima facie case of discrimination. And there was no indication of discrimination. What appellant did in this particular case was lump together three different cognizable groups and called it a Batson challenge.
I didn't think in your brief on appeal that you were disputing that you could, in fact, lump those together.
Not always, Your Honor. I understand under Diamapo that the Batson analysis can extend when there are multiple cognizable groups. However, the state's issue in this case is that all they did was lump them together. It may be a different situation, as in the Batson case itself, where the four strikes were used against the same cognizable group, and that cognizable group was relatable to the defendant in that case. In this case, there cannot be a blanket statement that a group of five minority jurors would have any racial relation to the defendant simply because they belong to a minority group themselves.
But the question isn't whether they have a relation to the defendant. I mean, they don't have to have a relation to the defendant. They still have an independent constitutional right to not be stricken because of their race. Isn't that true?
Yes, Your Honor. Only that I meant the spirit of Batson is that the state struck four black jurors because simply based on race. Sure. In this case, there was no indication that the state struck these five jurors who belonged to three different cognizable groups simply on the basis of race. In Batson, it was rather, I shouldn't say easy, but understandable to make that connection because of the race of the defendant. But there is no instance of that in this case.
Well, but this defendant was arguing that the facts suggested an immigration issue that added to the analysis at step one that should have been considered and took it over the low bar there. Can you comment on that?
Yes, Your Honor. First, I would argue that immigration status is not a race-based discrimination factor. I understand, especially with the current climate, that it could be tied to a racial basis. But again, they did not connect it to all five of these jurors that were struck. Arguably, on face value, you could possibly connect it to the two Latino jurors who were struck. However, they did not connect it at all to the two black jurors or the Asian juror who was struck. Additionally, there are Caucasian jurors who may deal with immigration issues and could be sensitive to that issue as well. What appellant's argument here begs this court to do is find that simply because they are not Caucasian, they would be more sensitive to immigration issues, when that simply cannot be said as true. Additionally, Your Honors, appellant asks this court to find that the state made an incorrect determination during jury selection because they decided to strike these five jurors when there were Caucasian jurors available. However, the state should not be limited to simply striking Caucasian jurors simply because they're available. They did not point to any Caucasian juror who would be similarly situated as one of the minorities who were struck.
That's step three analysis, isn't it? You're not doing that at prima facie showing at step one.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, that was appellant's argument. Appellant is the one who argued at step one that the state should have struck Caucasian jurors because they were available rather than the state. The state did not bring that up because we did not make it to step three, which is appropriate. To be sure, this court prefers a full three-step analysis. However, under Cooper, it's not required. Therefore, the district court did not err by making this decision.
So you agree that we should analyze the sufficiency of this record as purely a step one analysis?
I believe that it is sufficient to analyze it on step one because it is so clear that appellant was unable to prove a prima facie case of discrimination. And the standard here is clear error because the district court's ultimate decision was clear as to why step one was not found, then that record is complete.
I had a different question, which was, do you agree that it did not go beyond step one? So our analysis should just limit it to step one analysis.
Yes, Your Honor. Step one was not met. Therefore, the court decided that step two and three would not be appropriate to proceed to. However, there is a sufficient record to find that even a step three analysis would have failed because, as previously stated, appellant never pointed to any discriminatory purpose when they were asked multiple times. And that certainly would be an aspect of step three because it would fail on that. It could be affirmed based on the step one analysis, but even if Your Honors believe step three would have helped, you can look at the record and find that step three would not have been met in this case.
Can we move on?
Yeah, I was going to do that.
I want to hear about the Dr. Simon's testimony, and how do you distinguish that from the Smith versus Arizona decision from just last year?
Yes, Your Honor. This case simply has different facts than the Smith versus Arizona case. This case is more akin to Flowers versus State, which came before this court, I believe, 3 years ago. In Smith versus Arizona, we're looking at an analyst who looked at test results run by a machine for their conclusions. In this case, we're looking at a coroner who did her own testing in a way to come to her conclusions and findings regarding the death of the victim in this case.
But how do you explain, as counsel was saying over here, that parts of the photographs that were relied upon wouldn't have shown the depth of the wounds, yet she was able to testify about that? So she didn't do her own independent investigations. The suggestion is that they had to rely on some sort of testimonial evidence to come to those conclusions.
Yes, Your Honor. The state's position would be the autopsy record itself, and the victim's medical records would have been business records. As I believe Your Honor's pointed out, autopsies are conducted every day, and they are not always for homicide cases. Therefore, they would come in under the business record exclusion. However, they were not even admitted in this case because the coroner was able to testify to her own findings and conclusions based on a variety of things. They looked at the victim's medical records, the autopsy report, the photos of the crime scene, the photos of the autopsy themselves. I understand only six photos were admitted into evidence. However, the coroner testified that she looked at all of the autopsy photos. So it was not limited to just those six photos.
So are you saying that this witness, the testifying witness, could rely on the depth of the wound from the autopsy report without contradicting Smith or violating the confrontation clause rights here?
Certainly, Your Honor, because those were a business record. The autopsy report was written for that.
You're saying it's not testimonial?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because as the Supreme Court made clear in Smith, whether it satisfies a state evidentiary rule is not the question.
Yes, Your Honor, it would not be testimonial. Additionally, in this case, it was not pertinent to this testifying coroner's findings and conclusion whether or not, she looked at a variety of things to make her own findings and conclusions, not just the autopsy report. In Smith, all that testifying analyst did was look at the report. So this is a completely different situation. Additionally, I'd like to note that appellant did not cross-examine the coroner on this issue, they did briefly in one question ask what they used to make their findings and conclusions, to which they testified that they used a variety of tools. However, they mostly focused on the toxicology levels of the victim, which is likely because the issue of cause and manner of death of the victim was really not at issue in this case. I would point this court to page 568 of the record in the third appendix, where during opening statement, appellant made very clear that he is not disputing that he stabbed this victim. So it really wasn't an issue for them, which is why they waived that cross-examination.
That's interesting. So let's assume for a moment that we thought it was a violation of the Confrontation Clause rights. We would then, what would the harmlessness standard be?
Well, it would be under Valdez versus State, it would be harmless if the state could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the issue would be harmless. And we certainly can do that in the record. As I just stated, the victim, appellant himself admitted to stabbing the victim. The intent can clearly be shown in this situation. This was not someone who wandered and stumbled drunkenly into a situation. He came onto the premise voluntarily. He was removed from the premise by a third party, and he intentionally came back to engage. And he engaged with the third party, the victim.
The murder weapon wasn't found. Is that true?
I believe so, Your Honor.
And then when the defense at trial acknowledged or didn't dispute that he had stabbed the victim, did they acknowledge that it was with a knife?
I apologize, Your Honor. I am uncertain as to whether he specifically stated it was a knife. Okay. However, I would submit to Your Honors that the fact that he stated he stabbed the victim is enough. It wouldn't really matter if it was a knife. It constitutes as a deadly weapon in this case, as it caused
it
death.
It would be a sharp force object, or that's the terminology used by Dr. Simons was something like
yes,
that.
Sure.
Yeah, thank you.
Which, just briefly, I will touch on the expert testimony, as appellant stated that they would like to address that as well. Dr. Pohl was not able to provide a legal conclusion in this case, not that he was unable to speak to an ultimate issue in the case. What appellant wanted Dr. Pohl to do in this case was tell the jury definitively that the appellant could not have formed the requisite intent at a specific time to do a specific act. That would have taken the jury's ability to consider and weigh the elements of intent away from them and provide them with only one possibility. Additionally, Dr. Pohl was not qualified to make that determination. What he did was interview appellant and rely on his self-serving statements. He was not there at that time, and doing so would remove him from being an expert and make him an all-knowing being. And lastly, to appellant's point about Pundick, that case deals with a not guilty by reason of insanity case, which of course was not presented in this case. Therefore,
the legal analysis wasn't limited to NGRI, was it?
Your Honor, I believe it was. May I briefly answer your question and conclude?
Yes, please.
Thank you. In Pundick, it states very specifically that this is a not guilty by reason of insanity case, which is why it would be allowed. In this case, we don't have a not guilty by reason of insanity. It's a specific intent, which is not a statutory defense. And for the foregoing reasons, the state respectfully requests that this court affirm the judgment of conviction. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
With regard